enthusiast that meets monthly to have a potluck and share audio that catches our ears, maybe doesn't have a project that fits it yet, or could use a fresh listen. So feel free to bring friends, ideas, and your enthusiasm for sound. No experience necessary. For more information, you can visit the Threshold Shift program page at kbu.fm.
KBOO Portland.
Good morning, and welcome to November Black Book Talk. I'm Emma Jackson Ford, Bookwoman, and I'm here with
Patricia Hill Welch, excuse me, the former library lady, still looking for that new title.
And we have a very special guest today. Our guest is William Hayashi. He is the author of a book called Discovery One. Welcome.
Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure being here.
Oh, the pleasure is all ours. I can't wait to hear about not only Discovery One, but the other two books in the series.
Well, it was an unusual labor of love. Discovery was the first book I've ever written. And it was kind of surprising that the genesis of it, you know, for people who don't know, I'm a biracial author. But one of the things that always bothered me was the depiction of African Americans in literature and common culture and things like that, because none of the black folks that I grew up with, you know, on the south side of Chicago were ever represented in that cultural lexicon. You know, you had athletes, you had Oprah, you had rappers, you had, you know, all kinds of entertainers, but not just everyday, plain old, you know, do their job, have a great life kind of African American. And I think the biggest pushback against depicting the normalcy that I experienced growing up was when Bill Cosby had his last show, where you had a black doctor who married a black lawyer and had teenage children who had what were essentially considered white problems. And people said, oh, that's not realistic.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah, there was so much pushback when that show came on the air. People were like, this is not true. And I thought, one, it's not a documentary. And two, it is true if you know more about black life than the stereotypes. Yeah.
Well, and I think that, you know, it's not a conspiracy, but there has certainly been an effort not to normalize the role of African Americans in our culture, you know, for various reasons. So one of the reasons why I wrote the book was I wanted to write a book that, here were my goals. I wanted to write something that had never been written before, because I really had a lot of pushback against people who said, oh, all the plots have been done, all the stories have been written, there's nothing new to write about there, you can only see variations. And I wanted to write about the people I grew up with. And given, I grew up in the University of Chicago neighborhood of Hyde Park, which is ostensibly back in the 60s, 70s, was a fairly well-off neighborhood. It was middle class, upper middle class, but it also had working class. It was very, very cosmopolitan. So those were the goals. And I wanted to just tell a story that had regular people in it, but still had an extraordinary story to tell, and that was the genesis of what I started.
Go on, Emma.
I was going to say that when I first heard about the trilogy, starting mm-hmm. with Discovery One, when Denorja, one of my friends, mentioned it the first time, and I asked her to explain a little about your book, I remember thinking that it reminded me of the little towns that were in Oklahoma and Florida where black people lived and were doing well, and that people had a lot of problems with it. So I was really that other people had a lot of problems with it. So I remember chuckling to myself about the idea of a discovery of black scientists already living on the moon. Wonder what or he was going with that story.
Well, yeah, that's actually the gist of the story, and that's sort of kind of a spoiler for people who want to read Discovery. But essentially, the elevator pitch for the Dark Side trilogy is it tells a story of what happens in the United States of America when the country finds out that African Americans have been secretly living on the backside of the moon since before Neil Armstrong got there. You know, I had to refine that pitch because you need an elevator pitch. You want to be able to tell people what it's about in a short amount of time and tell up to describe the story in a way that's compelling enough that people would want to take another look at it.
Well, I think that's pretty darn compelling. I mean, quite frankly, even though certainly there are other sci-fi writers, still the notion that black people will be in the future, that black people have any really intense involvement with science and technology is still, unfortunately, a foreign notion to many people. So that, you know, to me, it's always exciting to pick up anything that's sci-fi, fantasy, or whatever, and see that we are there, because in so many cases, we have not. So, and the idea that not only are we there, but we got there before you, oh my gosh.
Well, it's an idea. I mean, nobody ever thought that something like that was you know, kind of a story to tell. When I was growing up, you know, what did I have? I had Star Trek, where we had one black woman as a regular. But for the most part, the rest of the African Americans in the stories, except for very, very few, was that guy in the red shirt who usually died before the first commercial.
Yes.
And so that's a big joke among science fiction fans, and especially among blacks. But and then Richard Pryor famously talked about, I forget what the beginning of his bit was, but essentially what he said was, judging by all these movies and TV shows, they don't intend for black folks to be around in the future.
Exactly.
Which, and so now we have a kind of a paradigm shift. You know, two Novembers ago, a study came out that showed that movies that have a more diverse cast, that have a cast that reflects the way America looks now, make more money. Okay. I don't know if that has actually penetrated the mindset of Hollywood, but we do see a lot more vehicles where African Americans play much, much more prominent roles. We have the excitement about the Black Panther movie.
Yes.
We have the fact that Luke Cage broke Netflix for 2 days.
Yes.
We have, although there's a lot of whining about it, we have a black lead in the latest Star Trek franchise.
Oh, yeah.
So things are changing to that extent. And then you look at the Afrofuturism kind of, or it's not a perception, it's not a genre, but it's kind of like a cultural phenomenon where, you know, there are a lot of black creatives doing content. You know, they're doing webisodes, they're doing TV shows online, they're doing movies, they're doing books. There's a plethora of comic books and other kinds of media. I'm fortunate enough that I do a radio show every Friday night that streams out on the internet called the Genesis Science Fiction Radio Show, and I get to interview for 2 hours, a two-hour interview of black creatives in all manner of genres, you know. And the coolest part about doing that show for me is I never would have met or even have maybe heard of any of those people had I not done that show. So it's always an adventure for me to get somebody new who is you know, is creating something in that kind of genre, either an Afrofuturist genre or or a black themed or black charactered piece of creative work and art as well.
Tell us a little bit more about the show. I mean, we're essentially in the same position as you, in that there are a lot of people that we're talking to, like you, for instance, that we wouldn't be aware of. We certainly wouldn't have a chance to talk to, but for this show. So, you know, just first of all, tell us how you even started, you know, to do the show. How did you become involved in Genesis Science Fiction Radio?
Well, it's actually a service of the BlackScienceFictionSociety.com website. And I had been told about that website by a friend of mine here in Chicago who was, I was in a writer's networking group. So I joined and saw, you know, there is just an unbelievable amount of content on there. There's stories, there's artwork, there's scholarly articles, there's video, audio. I mean, it's really a gathering place, and it's got like a membership of about 5,000 people currently. It doesn't cost anything to join. You just sign up and jump on board. They have an online chat, and about 5 years ago, they were thinking of putting together a radio show, and I've been in radio through the 70s and 80s, so I said I would love to get in on that. And the format hasn't it's changed a little bit. You know, there used to be a call-in part where people would call in and want to talk to the special guests, but a lot of that turned into the call-in person's show. They tried to hijack it, kind of eliminated that. And I'm just being honest. But what has happened is I was one of maybe three or four hosts at that time, and most of them have dropped off by the wayside. So I'm usually I'm the regular host for the Friday night show, and it starts at 9 p.m. Eastern time and goes till, you know, goes for 2 hours. And it's live, online. We don't broadcast through the air at all. And then all of the shows are stored as podcasts. So you can go back and, you know, if you find somebody, let's say you discovered a comic book at one of these conventions, and I actually interviewed the creator of the comic book. You could actually go back and hear a two-hour interview about the comic book creator, you know, what their life was like, what brought them to actually produce, you know, the comic book they did and what their influences were. And I think that's a really great resource because, you know, like I said, there's 5 different shows where I've interviewed, you know, any number of people. So that's the genesis of the show, and it's called the Genesis Science Fiction Radio Show, came out of the BlackScienceFictionSociety.com website. And the BlackScienceFictionSociety.com website also produces its own magazine. It has produced a number of anthologies, you know, stories by its members. So there's a wealth of information, there's a wealth of creativity there that I think a lot of people wouldn't find out about otherwise, you know, if they didn't go there.
That is a lot of information. Yeah, I could see myself very easily going there.
We've been joined by a third member, OB Hill, who is the third member of our team. Good morning, OB.
Good morning. Hello, sir. How are you doing?
I am doing well. How about you?
Oh, I mixed the Mac, so I won't make it to the moon.
You know, let me tell you a funny story about that. You know, obviously, as an author, I look to, you know, I hope to get great reviews on Amazon. All right, because that sometimes if somebody bumps into a book on Amazon, you know, seeing positive reviews is far, far more compelling than just reading some advertising about something. So one day I logged on just to kind of see what was going on, and I saw that I had a 1-star review. And, you know, I have to admit that I was pretty upset. You know, it's like, oh my God, you know, how could somebody say, because most of my reviews are 5-star or 4-star. And then when you talk about the last two installments, they're all 5-star reviews. So, a lot of those, you know, most of those people are strangers. It's not as if I stack the deck. So anyway, I've got this 1-star review, and the gentleman said that you could tell he was white, and he said that he he just couldn't get into the story because it seemed to him like a Saturday Night Live skit. You know, why would African Americans in America want to leave Earth and go live secretly on the moon with just their own kind?
He actually wrote that.
Well, yeah, but wait. You know, I was angry at first, but then I thought, you know what? This is actually pretty good. You know, it took a little while to get there, okay? I admit it took a while to get there. But, I mean, stop and think about it. You know, to have that perspective just points out the dichotomy between how white the life that African Americans have in this country versus, you know, the view that African Americans have. You know, and I think that's one of the problems with, you know, just generally, and I'll say quick, the Black Lives Matter movement, because whites don't have the same perception of America that we do. They certainly don't have the same experience with police officers that we do, and all kinds of things that suggest why we may be enchanted with our society. So after getting over that and thinking about it, that's the review actually that when I go on you know, to speak about what I've done and to talk about the Dark Side trilogy, I put that one up there. And I put that one up there to point out that why I thought writing the series would have been necessary, why I thought that the Dark Side trilogy had something to say. And it just took me a little while to get to that perspective, but it's the most perfect review that I could have from someone who's not African American.
I know there are 7 volumes planned in all for the Dark Side. At least I'm assuming they're all called the Dark Side, or is it just the trilogy?
Well, the first trilogy is the Dark Side trilogy. The second trilogy, of which I just finished the second volume Monday, is called the Archangel X trilogy, but it's in the Dark Side universe. Mm-hmm. And the 7th volume actually winds up the entire saga. And those are the plans. You know, at first I thought I was writing a single book. But when I got to the middle of Discovery, I realized that the ending that I had planned did not in any way tell the full story. So I realized that I had a trilogy of books to write, and then, like life, you know, when you go through life, if somebody tells your story, you know, does an autobiography, or you do an autobiography about your life, and you're still around, your life still goes on after the events in that last, you know, in your autobiography. So, you know, life does go on for these people, and I figured that I could tell more of the story and actually give it some pretty exciting twists in the second trilogy. And then the final volume, I really want to close it out because I have other things that I want to write. So what I'm doing is this last book, I don't know how many thousand words it is. It's over 150,000, which is, I guess, a little bit a lot. But once I get done with this last trilogy, which is going much, much quicker because I'm spending more time on it, I will take a break before I do that 7th book. And then I may offer an 8th volume, but the 8th volume is going to be an anthology of other authors who write in the Dark Side universe, who may have read one of the volumes and had their own spin on telling a story from the Dark Side universe. But I'm pretty sure that will be it. After that, I'm going to want to move on.
Great. Are you mentoring other younger people who may be interested in science fiction writing?
Am I a what? I'm sorry?
A mentor to younger writers who may be interested in carrying on your tradition.
I do a little bit. I do it in writers' groups. And when people approach me and want help with their books and things like that, I am fairly, at least I think I'm generous with my time, but yes, I am. And there's 2 reasons for that. One, I want to encourage other people to be as creative as possible. But 2, when you encourage other people to read and write, you're also increasing the possible number of people who will be attracted to your own work. So there's a little bit of self-interest in that, but also I've taught at the elementary, the high school, and the college level, and being able to share what little I have to help other people with doing their own stories is something that is not a problem with me at all.
What do you do when you're not writing? My impression is that you're not a full-time writer.
No, I'm still earning my money fixing computers and things like that. I've been in the IT field basically since about 1970. And, I've had my own company since the early 80s. And I take care of, I take care of businesses that need, a little bit of cleaning up or maybe some help setting up, things like that, also protecting themselves from threats. Online threats and people sending bad code out, viruses and things like that. So I'm pretty much an IT specialist, and I've been one for a lot of years. One of the reasons why I got into writing was I wanted to transition into something else, but until I can get, 10, 20, 30, 45, 50,000 people buying each book that I put out, I'm still going to have to deporn laptops and do things like that.
Oh, would you share a passage from your book with us?
Oh yeah, that caught me kind of unexpected today. I didn't know that you would want me to read something. I think I'm going to read the very beginning of Discovery, because if people hear it and they think that I've at least started out well and it's interesting, they may like it. Is that okay with you guys?
Absolutely.
Love that.
This is the very start of Discovery, which is Volume 1 of the Dark Side Trilogy. As with many discoveries, finding asteroid 2005 XF-13 was more the result of serendipity than hard work. After what seemed like a long, uneventful winter, Norma's discovery of the asteroid brought enough excitement to her life to propel her out of the winter doldrums into spring. Norma Lancaster was just finishing up her last year of study in astrophysics at the University of Chicago. She attended U of C for the last 6 years after graduating from a small suburban high school with straight A's and a perfect SAT score. She was extremely bright, but she had an easy way with people. Everyone she met saw her as warm and approachable, not your run-of-the-mill computer geek. On this particular Monday, she arrived at her small cubicle in one of the Geological Science Department's laboratories, dropped her books on her desk, and checked her weekend's email. While her workstation was booting up, she looked around and once again vowed to clean up her cubicle. She could find anything she needed, but it made her look rather unorganized. Norma had no new email messages waiting for her. She turned her attention to the weekend-run digital images uploaded from the observatory on the edge of the Mauna Loa volcano in Hawaii. These pictures, negatives of the night sky, black dots on a white background, were the stuff of which her dreams were made. She lacked the patience to spend hours gazing into the night sky on her own, learning quadrant by quadrant, but she secretly hoped that she would discover a new world or asteroid that would bear her name in perpetuity. Instead of spending her nights in solitary contemplation of the sky, Norma had written a suite of programs that compared digital images of the sky and black items that appeared, moved, or disappeared over time. The hardest part of her project was writing the programs to map the thousands of stars into her computerized sky so that the images could be perfectly compared against each other. The search and comparison programs had earned her a grant from NASA in digital image processing and were the precursor for an automated for discovery and plotting new bodies in the sky. "Hey, Norma, baby, what's shaking?" came over the top of her cube. She looked up at the familiar face of research fellow Alan Richard, with his brown wavy hair wildly askew atop his head and warm brown eyes twinkling in an easygoing humor. "Nothing yet, but as you know, on any given Monday, anything can happen," they both finished together. Alan was a University of Chicago fellow working on his own project and a very low-maintenance lab mate. He had no real annoying habits like humming to himself or tapping his pen on the desk or questionable hygiene. Most of the time, Norma felt lucky to share her space with him instead of some dense-mouthed freezer with overactive hormones and bad skin. So anyway, the reason why I'm stopping now, the reason why I started out at the University of Chicago is I grew up in that neighborhood, and it's a great institution, and I wanted, you know, some kind of connection from home when I started up the book. This is the first book that I've ever written. I had never written anything like this. I've done some short stories, obviously, in college and things like that, but this was big. And I didn't know what I was doing, so I tried to stick with some familiar things and move on from there. It wasn't easy. You know, I don't know what other people, authors, think about writing. I mean, you guys have interviewed so many people. I mean, do they generally, I mean, have you talked to a lot about first-time authors who have expressed problems getting started?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it seems to depend on the author. There's some authors who are like, unfortunately, name is escaping me, well-known sort of mystery writer. It's just going to come to me. At any rate, there's some writers who just say they write every day. That's just it, good, bad, or indifferent. There are others who seem to feel like their characters take over the work almost. Once they get into that zone, it's like they're not even writing it. And you know, there are folks who, it's a struggle. They have to rewrite, and that's just the work. So it really does seem to vary.
Yeah, for me, a lot of that stuff I have now experienced. You know, I've finished six manuscripts, and when I write, one of the things that I discovered early on for discovery was to treat writing like a part-time job. So what I did way back then, and this was in 2001, I actually wrote it in 9 months in 2001, and what would happen was at 10 p.m. every night, I would stop whatever I was doing, I would sit down in front of the computer, and I would start writing or editing. And by doing that every day, I didn't fall into the trap that I had seen a lot of other authors who I had met here in Chicago fall into, which is, you know, I would talk to somebody, I'm working on a manuscript, I'm doing this, and they would go, oh yeah, me too, I'm writing a book as well. And I go, really, how long have you been working on it? Well, you know, I've been doing it for about 11 years, and I'm going, and then I would ask, well, what's stopping you from doing it? And they always said pretty much the same thing. Well, life came along, I got married, I had kids, my job changed, this, I'm too tired. And so I realized early on that if I didn't treat it like a part-time job, like something that I had to do every day, punch the clock, and get it started, it wasn't going to happen. So that was the first thing that really kind of put my nose to the grindstone.
We are so glad you put the effort into it. So glad you did. I can't wait to finish the trilogy.
Really? You actually started reading it?
I have actually bought the first one, and I've told my sons about it, so I'm looking forward to it. Unfortunately, we are at the end of our time for our November show. I want to say again, thank you for writing the trilogy, and thank you for saying yes to being on our show today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you all for having me.
Okay, and you'll have to come back.
Bye-bye.
We have announcements.
I will.
Okay.
Okay.
We're going to use our last few minutes to just say there's so much happening this weekend, and we want people to know about it. On this coming Saturday, the 5th, Roland Martin, who's the news director and anchor of TV1's news show, will be speaking at Maranatha Church at 6 o'clock. On Sunday, there's going to be a festival of gospel and jazz starting at 6 o'clock at the Old Church. On Wednesday, November 8th, from 10 to 15, Renee Watson is going to be at the North Portland Library, and the program is called The Power of the Written Word, and Paige Turner's Black Voices, which is also at the North Portland Library, but they're going to be hosting Denorja Price, who will be talking about her black sci-fi book, Seedling. So tons of stuff going on. We're getting into the season where there are going to be author visits and incredible cultural events, and we hope that you'll join us for them. And we hope that you will also send your notifications of things that are happening. So thank you very much for listening, and we'll see you, hear you, talk to you next month.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of KBOO at the Clinton screening of Romeo is Bleeding on Thursday, November 9th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater in Portland. Romeo is Bleeding is a documentary that follows Dante Clark, a young poet transcending the violence in his hometown of Richmond, California, by writing about his experiences. Dante and the like-minded youth of the city mount an urban adaptation of Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, with the hope of starting a dialogue about violence in the city. PDX Poetic Justice's John Slaughter and his group of poets will be reading some of their works before the screening. Again, that's KBOO at the Clinton screening of Romeo is Bleeding on Thursday, November 9th at 7 p.m. at the Clinton Street Theater, 2522 Southeast Clinton Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
KBOO Portland. This KBOO program has been made possible in part by KBOO Foundation members and a grant from Portland Saturday Market, open daily December 16 through December 24 for the Festival of the Last Minute. Saturday Market offers handmade arts, crafts, and other gifts created by artists from the Pacific Northwest and is located at 2 Southwest Ankeny in Waterfront Park. Information at Portland, SaturdayMarket.com.